And I won't name any names, but this enlisted person went back to visit his former girlfriend. And
that must have been interesting.
It was very interesting. Obviously, they had both aged. But the most interesting thing was when he visited her home, he saw all these Viet Cong decorations on the wall. So much to his dismay, he learned that the love of his life at the time was actually a communist spy.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
This is Stephen Phillips. I have the deck and the con for today's podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. John Sherwood. Dr. Sherwood is a historian at the Naval History and Heritage Command, where he has served since 1997. He has a PhD in history from the George Washington University and has authored 6 books to include War in the Shallows, U.S. Navy Coastal and Riverine Warfare in Vietnam, 1965 to 1968. He's currently working on a book about sea services humanitarian operations. John, welcome to Preble Hall.
Thank you, Steve.
Perhaps the popular introduction to the Riverine Forces in Vietnam is the movie Apocalypse Now. Please share with the audience the origins of the Brown Water Navy in Vietnam.
Well, my first comment is about the movie. Great movie, but it has nothing to do with the U.S. Navy. And I want everybody listening to this to not interpret that movie as the U.S. Navy in Vietnam. And the reasons for this are it portrayed the enlisted force in the movie as kind of the bottom of the barrel conscript type. And that was definitely not the case during the Vietnam War. The average sailor in the Riverine Force was someone who volunteered twice. He volunteered for the Navy, went through basic training, and then had to volunteer again for brown water service. And so it was quite selective. And some of the finest sailors during the period served in the Brown Water Navy. And there are some other issues with the movie as well. Tactics, you would never have a PBR, patrol boat river, traveling alone. They always traveled in 2-boat sections so that one could cover the other, especially searching sampans, as that boat did in the movie. And the third thing I'd like to say about the movie is the boat captain, who is portrayed by Albert Hall. There were enlisted boat captains. I'll talk more about that later on in the podcast. But African Americans were not highly represented in the Brown Water Force because of institutional racism at the time. And we could spend a whole other podcast on that topic. But to suffice it to say, in all of my research, I never uncovered a single boat captain who was African American. But now I'll turn to the origins of the Brown Water Force. The origins stretch all the way back to the first Indochina War, which was 1946 to 1954. It was basically the French trying to hold on to their colonial power versus the Viet Minh, who were communist forces attempting to gain the independence of the country from France. The French employed what they called dinasso, which was a unit of 12 to 14 boats, mainly converted American World War II landing craft, LCMs. Each dinasso was designed to move approximately 400 personnel to flashpoints, mainly on the Red River Delta, and then provide gunfire support and logistics for those forces once they engaged with the enemy. That concept basically was adopted whole cloth later on in the U.S. Vietnam War by the Americans. But I should point out that the French were the ones who came up with that concept. DNSOs were often used in joint operations with mechanized infantry and airborne units, something that later the Mobile Riverine Force under the U.S. also did. When the first Indochina War ended in 54 with the fall of Dien Bien Phu, the country was partitioned, and the North was communist, the South was a republic, and the South immediately formed a new armed force and, of course, a navy. The navy was actually established by the French in 53, and by the time the war ended, it had four DNSO and a variety of other coastal and riverine patrol boats. By 1965, it had about 200 ocean-going ships, or really sea-going ships, 200 riverine and coastal boats, and over 8,000 personnel. But there were some problems with the force. There was poor pay and morale. The force was divided into three elements: a sea force, which was kind of their blue water force, a river force, which was riverine, and then a coastal force. The coastal force was manned 100% by irregulars, and it mainly consisted of motorized and sailing junks that were very lightly armed. And that was the real weak point in the Vietnam Navy, and what ultimately spurred U.S. intervention in 65. Another thing that I should point out is that in the 1963 Diem coup, the CNO, a very promising officer named Ho Tam Quyen, graduate of the French Naval Academy at Brest, a first-class guy, was shot by one of his own wardroom. And that devastated the morale of this nascent Navy, as one might expect. Now, how did the U.S. get involved? The U.S. got involved because in February of 1965, the U.S. Army helicopter actually discovered a trawler, a 100-ton trawler, unloading material in Vung Ro Bay. The arms, supplies, food in that trawler indicated that something had to be done about coastal infiltration. If the communist forces were allowed to move that much stuff in by sea, there would be a real problem holding on to South Vietnam. So that led to initially a barrier patrol along the border between North and South Vietnam with larger units, ocean-going minesweepers and DERs. And then the establishment of Market Time, which was the Coastal Surveillance Force. Now, Market Time was really not a part of the brown water Navy. We really consider it to be green water, which is coastal water. And it was essentially a blockading force. There were three barriers, an outer, a middle, and an inner. The inner barrier was essentially 1 to 10 miles, the middle 10 to 15, the outer 15 to 40. And the outer barrier was patrolled by larger U.S. naval warships, such as DERs or high-endurance Coast Guard cutters. The middle was the Vietnam Navy's sector, and the inner was going to be PCFs and WPBs. Those were the interceptors. So if anything was detected in the outer barriers, once that junk or trawler got within the territorial waters of South Vietnam, which was 12 nautical miles, either Vietnam Navy or U.S. forces, usually U.S. forces, would make an intercept.
And Operation Market Time.
Correct.
Task Force 115.
Correct.
And when you break each of these down, you had three operations and each had a different task force number. Can you describe the other two and what their missions were?
Okay, the other two, you had Game Warden, which was stood up in 66, and it was the River Patrol Force. And by River Patrol Force, I don't mean that we had boats on every square inch of the 3,000 miles of waterways that make up the Mekong Delta and the Rungsat area, but just the major waterways. So the Mekong River the Bosak, Cochin, Hamlong, Mitah, and Saigon rivers. The idea was to assert government control over those main rivers so that supplies could move to important population centers, also prevent those rivers from being used by the enemy, but prevent major crossings from occurring, and to prevent the enemy from mining our ships, which was a major problem during the course of the war. So one of the things that's interesting about both Market Time and Game Warden was that the Navy didn't go out and develop riverine and coastal boats for this mission. They looked at what was available commercially, and for the PCF, they bought basically a ferry that was used to ferry oil workers to platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, and they added some guns and an 81-millimeter mortar and called it their interceptor. It was a very fast boat that could go over 25 knots. It was well-armed, but it wasn't well-armored. For the river force, they took a 31-foot cruiser made by Uniflight, which is a Bellingham, Washington commercial boat manufacturer. And they took out the engines, put in military-grade diesel engines, added a jacuzzi water jet. Now, water jets are very common now commercially with pleasure craft. Then it was a new innovation. And what the water jet enabled the boat to do was maneuver very easily, to spin like a top, to backwards and forwards up these narrow channels, so three-point turns were unnecessary, to skip over sandbars, to go very fast without worrying about hitting flotsam or jetsam. So a great boat for the rivers, heavily armed with 50 caliber machine guns and 30 caliber, not very well armored.
Did they ever have challenges with stuff getting sucked into their intakes?
They did, and it was generally the task of the new sailor to the unit to dive into the murky waters of the Mekong, and the waters of the Mekong could be filled with body parts, animal parts, but water hyacinth was the main thing that had to be cut out. Not a pleasant task at all.
I can imagine. And then the third task force was Task Force 117.
Yes.
When did they come into play, and what was their mission, and what kind of vessels did they employ?
Well, that's an interesting story. General Westmoreland, the overall commander of Military Assistance Command Vietnam, wanted to secure the Mekong Delta, which contained 3,000 miles of waterway, but it produced 75% of Vietnam's food, and it had 40% of the total South Vietnamese population. So it's important real estate, and what he wanted to do was to prevent the 50,000 Viet Cong that were operating there almost with impunity from essentially controlling that very valuable piece of real estate. And so he inserted the 9th Infantry Division, but he didn't have enough helicopters to use them in an air mobile capacity. So what he decided to do was to employ LCMs, as the French did with the Dinosaur, and essentially base that unit at the end of Route 4, which was at Mitah, the end of Dentong province, and try to use the MRF initially to search out and destroy large units of Viet Cong in those two provinces just south of Saigon. It's interesting that the Marine Corps weren't brought in because amphibious operations were essentially a Marine mission. But the Marines were very busy up in I Corps. That was probably the busiest military sector. That's along the border between North and South Vietnam. So the Marines were unavailable. So this was a marriage with the Army, and it worked out quite well. For command and control, they utilized a system that was developed in World War II, which meant that when the Mobile Riverine Force was steaming on the rivers, and it was mainly a bunch of converted landing craft like the French, it was under Navy control. As soon as that unit landed its troops, then the Army commander, usually in 06, took control of the battle.
That's interesting.
And then used the MR of these LCMs, which were heavily armored with 20 millimeter, and we had a monitor with 40 millimeter, and there were a few with flamethrowers. He would use those for his artillery support, kind of like tanks on the battlefield.
I think the Task Force 117 capabilities are not as well known. Could you unpack in a little bit more detail the vessels that 117 employed?
Okay. Interestingly enough, the two former task forces, they relied on speed and firepower. So boats that could steam 25 knots or higher, but not a lot of armor. With the Mobile Riverine Force, because they needed to use converted LCMs, so landing craft, because they were landing troops in amphibious warfare scenarios, they had to use LCM-6s. One of the problems with the LCM-6 is it could really only steam 8 knots. And in the Delta, with the swift-flowing rivers and the currents, sometimes you could be going 8 knots and barely moving forward, effective speed over water being like less than a knot. So one of the things that did for the MRF was it got everybody very concerned about tides, about currents. Bridges were a problem because if you entered an area with your troops and the tide went up, you might not be able to get under that bridge. So that was an interesting issue for the MRF. The other interesting issue was they tried to add a lot of armor to these boats, and they got these boats armored enough to prevent to stop a 50 caliber round, which is
right,
which is pretty significant, and some heat rounds, but they never were able to counter this rocket called the B-40, which had an 80 millimeter shell. It was shoulder fired. And what the B-40 would do is it would burn into the hull and shower the well deck with fragments. So it wouldn't sink the boat, but it
devastating
would
the personnel.
People.
Yeah.
And I actually interviewed a guy in Mitaw who was his job was to fire these rockets, and he talked about hearing the screams of the soldiers and sailors on those boats, and how he's still haunted to this day. Hearing those screams
right.
at night. So it was sort of an arms race. The NAVSEA tried to develop a special boat for the river from the keel up. It was called the Assault Support Boat, the Alpha Boat, or ASPB. And whereas all the other stuff was basically off the shelf, the ASPB was a complete failure for the most part.
And why was that?
It was not fast enough to keep up with the PBRs and later PCFs. It was not armored enough to stop the B-40. It didn't carry that many people. It could carry up to 8 SEALs. So in the final analysis, what they ended up using the boat for, it also several of them sunk pier side, so they weren't very seaworthy. So what they ended up using them for is minesweepers.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So fratricide, you know, accepting the damage. Interesting.
Wooden hulls, iron men.
Yeah. You described that Task Force 117 was based on land, but I'm aware that there were also elements that were based on the rivers. Can you describe the differences between each?
Sure. Let me talk about Game Warden first, because they were the first unit that utilize sea basing in a riverine context. Basically, U.S. government took 4 LSTs, landing ship tank, out of mothballs and made some minor modifications, basically added air conditioning, which was critical for the Mekong Delta. It's very hot. Refurbished the galley and the mess decks, but not the berthing areas. Improved communications, added a boom for handling PBRs, a helicopter landing deck, which was very important because HAL 3, the largest helicopter squadron ever established by the U.S. Navy, would be deployed to provide close air support and improve communications. And they moved these to basically the mouths of various rivers or areas where there was a lot of space between the LST, large slow target, and the shoreline. And that allowed the PBRs to basically access different parts of the delta without having to establish land bases at the very few towns that existed in the delta. For the land bases, it was mainly we would co-locate with a Vietnam Navy riverine unit, usually in a large town, and they were not very secure bases. They might have some kind of perimeter, but it was easy for the enemy to throw a grenade into the camp or fire a mortar round or something
right.
like that.
So they were exposed.
So the sea bases provided security. They also provided a place for sailors to dry out. One of the problems with the Mekong Delta that they learned early on is that if you stayed out in the delta more than 24 hours, you could get something, especially if you were a soldier walking around the rice fields, you could get something called paddy foot. And paddy foot was basically like athlete's foot on steroids.
Okay.
It produced a fever, high fever, and you basically basically became a medical casualty, and you would have to go rest and recover. This greatly hampered the effectiveness of the Mobile Riverine Force because the troops could only operate so long, 2 or 3 days, and then they had to go back to either a land or a land base. They had one land base or one of the river bases and then dry their feet out.
So the LSTs acted as a mothership, and they could go and then rest and relax in the berthing and that sort of thing, dry out, get ready for the next day's mission.
Yeah, they were even more than that. They provided some of the comforts of home. You could get ice cream. You could get good Navy food.
Right.
Even being on a ship and hearing the bells was comforting. The ships also had guns, 40-millimeter guns, that would occasionally engage in naval gunfire support. So those were quite handy as well. They had medical facilities in case you got sick or you needed medical attention. They provide, because of the helicopter pad, if you required higher level medical attention, you could be choppered off very easily. So yes, very significant. I should point out that the Mobile Riverine Force didn't use LSTs, they used barrack ships, Binawa APB-35, Colleton APB-36, and non-self-propelled barrack ships like APL-26, known as the Apple, or YRBM-16.
Interesting. I want to go back to the mine warfare piece. As a former EOD diver, I'm always interested in mine warfare. So could you unpack for me in more detail how the Vietnamese employed mines against the U.S. Navy?
Yes, the Vietnamese were very talented at mine and sapper warfare. We think that some of the people who served with the Viet Cong were actually former Vietnam Navy combat swimmers, frogmen. The first significant mining was the USNS Card, which was a former aircraft carrier being used as an aircraft ferry, and commandos attached satchel charges to the hull, killing 5 civilians. It happened right in downtown Saigon. It was a huge public relations fiasco. Some of the more famous journalists covered it, saying, do we want to get involved in this war if they can blow up an aircraft carrier right in Saigon? But there were other examples as well. Baton Rouge Victory, which was a military sea transportation service ship, was mined on the Long Tao River, which is the river going to Saigon. 7 members of its crew died, largest loss of civilian mariners during the war. YRBM-16, which is a berthing and messing barge for the MRF, was attacked in 1967, killing 7 sailors, wounding another 14. Westchester County, an LST, 18 sailors killed in November of 1968. countering mine warfare was a major reason for why we established Task Force 116 to begin with, the River Patrol Force. And throughout the war, we deployed riverine minesweepers. The first were the MSBs, and the MSBs were 57-foot minesweepers, and they were part of something called Mine Squadron 11, and so many of those were lost that that unit actually earned the Presidential Unit Citation.
Interesting.
During the war.
Lost to mines.
Lost to mines.
Wow.
Or ambushed.
Right.
Ambushed. Mm-hmm. Mostly ambushed, because they had to go very slowly to do their sweeps, and that made them vulnerable.
Very vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember reading a book called Defender Dolphins about Vietnam was the first use of dolphins as counter swimmer, because, to your point, a lot of the mines were being emplaced by swimmers. So
a cruder methodology often employed was to assign a sailor to the deck with a box of a crate of hand grenades, and every so often at random times he would drop a hand grenade in the river.
And that would serve as a deterrent for sure.
Yeah.
Earlier you were talking about the fact that enlisted sailors were placed in positions of responsibility in the Brown Water Navy. One of the most famous Brown Water sailors was Medal of Honor recipient James Williams. Can you share his story?
Yes. James Williams was an enlisted sailor. He served with River Section 531, based in Mitaw. And he was quickly promoted to boat captain and later patrol officer. So he commanded a two-boat patrol. And I'll quote his commanding officer, Fred McDavitt. Fred said, "When you get fired at during an ambush, even if it's not the first time, you can't believe this is happening to you. You often have no frame of reference, and the first reaction to fire is extreme fear and paralysis. However, a good combat leader can break through that fear and the fear of his troops by calmly talking to them and telling them what to do." Williams had that skill. He had this great sense of situational awareness in combat. He was highly aggressive. He was a gambler. He loved to gamble, but he took calculated risks. After every patrol, he would gather his men and the officers around the horseshoe pit, and they would go over the day's action piece by piece. So he was definitely a lessons learned type of guy. And on 31 October 1966, he discovered a large collection of sampans moving a large unit, they think maybe 200, 300 personnel, across the river near Mitaw. And he was able to bring the fire of his unit, his two PBRs, plus HAL 3 helicopters, and basically destroy that unit. For that, he received a Medal of Honor. He was involved in quite a few other actions. When one of our dredgers was mined, he was the first unit to the scene, and one of his men, Reuben Binder, actually rescued some of the civilian mariners trapped on that dredger. So quite a guy. One of the interesting things about, and McDavitt points this out, is that some of his best, in fact, arguably his best boat captains and patrol officers were not officers, but enlisted personnel. There's no real reason for why this was the case, except for the fact that, as I've said, the enlisted personnel had to work harder to get into the unit than the officers, and those who could qualify for that job and who competed for that job really wanted the job, whereas some of the officers might have felt, this is just one more tour and I can move on. And in fact, I'm sitting on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Academy, and one interesting point of fact is very few naval academies served in TF-116 or TF-117.
I'm going to guess it was not thought of as a good career move.
Exactly.
I also wonder, what was the rotation? I've read about and studied Vietnam, and I think sometimes the enlisted and officer rotations were different. Were officers serving for shorter periods of time, or was it a situation where they'd go and they'd serve 6 months with the Brown Water Navy, but then get rotated to a staff in country?
It depended. There were some officers like Dusty Rhodes with the Mobile Riverine Force who had served previously on minesweepers, not in Vietnam, but in earlier in his career. But then he served as a naval advisor with the Vietnam Navy Riverine Force, and then as a squadron commander with the Mobile Riverine Force. So someone like him, he had tremendous experience. But most of the officers I met, they were coming in, they were doing one tour, and that was it. Whereas some of the enlisted personnel volunteered for multiple tours in country. And that may be one of the reasons why they were more proficient as boat captains. They simply had more experience.
I've also heard and read about the advisory capacity that you just referred to. And I know that a lot of advisory work was happening in the later stages in the Vietnamization of the war. But were there advisors throughout the entire period? And what exactly was their role?
There were advisors from 1954 all the way to the waning days of Vietnam. And these advisors are unsung heroes because they served with a Vietnam Navy unit. They fought with that unit and their counterparts. They had to live on Vietnamese food, which was often not agreeable with their systems. And they didn't have access to, especially in the early days, to medical evacuation if they got wounded. So some of the early Silver Star, Bronze Star recipients were naval advisors. It was a very tough job. It had no career benefit. It was a very lonely job because you were serving with a bunch of people who didn't speak your language in a very hot part of the world. Not fun, but the people, and not everyone took the job seriously, but those who did had a huge impact. Often, those who did were often able to motivate their counterparts to fight harder because the U.S. Navy is a highly motivated fighting force. Anywhere we go, we go to fight and win. The Vietnam Navy, they were more in a survival mode. They knew the war was going to last for a long time. They were not there for a year, and then they were going somewhere else. They were there for the duration. And
does change your perspective.
And I should say that the Vietnam Navy had its moments. The invasion of Cambodia performed extremely well. At the end of the war, the Vietnam Navy had the most cohesiveness of any of the ARVN units, and was able to organize and get most of its people and boats out of the country to the Philippines in this massive flotilla.
It's amazing.
And some of the officers, the Vietnam Navy eventually set up their own naval academy at Nha Trang, but the original officers were all trained at the French Military Academy in Brest, or Naval Academy. So very competent, very impressive group of officers. Enlisted were not paid very well, so often the enlisted didn't have the same motivation, but the officers were, many of the officers were highly motivated.
Interesting. Well, we've talked about that some of the Brown Water Navy folks were based ashore. We've talked about that you had advisors that interacted with them clearly on a daily basis. But there's also sailors that connected with Vietnamese in a local village or town. Can you describe some of those interactions?
Sure. Those interactions could range from Fred McDavitt, who is the CO of River Section 531. He took it upon himself to set up a small school in My Tho. And during his off hours, he tutored, I think the number is 125 local Vietnamese in English.
That's amazing.
And he was asked to do this by the local chief of police, that they needed more English speakers in the town. Then there were people who had Vietnamese girlfriends because the bases were, it wasn't like what we do today where the bases are isolated.
Inside a barrier, you know, and you go inside.
Behind
and,
the wire. Yeah. No. At the end of the day, you'd leave the base, you'd go to town, you'd have a meal, you'd have a Vietnamese beer, and friendships were formed. You'd hang out with your translators. You'd hang out with the local people you meet. And there were some relationships. And I went to Vietnam not too long ago with a group of Americans, one officer and one enlisted person. And I won't name any names, but this enlisted person went back to visit his former girlfriend.
And that must have been interesting.
It was very interesting. Obviously, they had both aged. But the most interesting thing was when he visited her home, he saw all these Viet Cong decorations on the wall. So much to his dismay, he learned that the love of his life at the time was actually a communist spy.
Oh, my gosh.
So
wow.
That was...
Talk about OPSEC.
That was, yeah, talk about OPSEC. It worked both ways because the NILOs would get information, the Navy intelligence liaison officers who were often stationed at these bases would gain information from some of the people that the sailors met, including their girlfriends. But yeah, it was a tricky situation. One of the other things that our forces did, and we still do this today, are medical civic action program, MedCAPs. So for example, in 1967, the Delta River Patrol Group, Task Group 116.1 provided medical treatment for 1,337 Vietnamese. So our hospital corpsmen would go literally door to door.
And this is like a Winning Hearts and Minds effort, right?
It's a Winning Hearts and Minds effort, but we still do this today. The Jennings County treated up to 1,100 civilian patients on MedCap missions in 67 alone. A lot of goods and food and other things were provided to the Vietnamese by our people, sometimes at their own expense.
Interesting. I think one more question, and that is, can you explain what happened during the Tet Offensive at My Tho?
Yeah, I can. The Tet Offensive in January of 68 was really a turning point in the war. It was a surprise attack across the country during the Tet holiday, their Lunar New Year. So most of the Arvin forces were at their houses celebrating this Lunar New Year. Nearly every town in the Delta, including My Tho, were attacked and were under siege during the Tet Offensive. In the case of My Tho, the 116 sailors, what happens when you get attacked, get in your boat.
And skedaddle. Yeah.
And you come back and you provide gunfire support. You regroup.
Right.
It's not like you run away.
But you're going to your strength. This is your strength is being on the river, being armed.
Your strength is firepower and mobility.
Right.
You've got that with the boat.
Right.
And they did take huge risks with their boats during both in My Tho and Ben Tre to provide fire support for those unlucky enough not to be on a boat. So I don't want to say anything disparaging about those guys. But those who are left are transients who are being flown out of the country or naval support activity sailors. And I should say something about naval support activity sailors. More sailors served in a logistics support role in Vietnam than served in all the three combat task forces alone. You know, these are your yeomen. These are your box kickers, your storekeepers,
right.
those types of guys, you know, the guys that keep the wheels on the bus.
Right.
And bless their hearts, those guys, led by a small group of SEALs, defended their compound in My Tho, defended their billeting hotels. They were basically hotels, and they got on the roofs, they sandbagged the rooms, and they defended their compound until the Mobile Riverine Force could send in reinforcements.
That's amazing.
And the Mobile Riverine Force, that's what they did. They, You know, as soon as TED happened, they all got on their converted LCMs.
Right.
And started relieving the sieges in each town, mm-hmm. sometimes operating in a distributed fashion with some units going to one place and others going to another. But again, that mobility and firepower and logistics support at a time when there were no helicopters available.
Right. How long was the fighting going on? Was this like was it a week long offensive?
No. It went on through March.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. John Sherwood, author of War in the Shallows, U.S. Navy Coastal and Riverine Warfare in Vietnam, 1965 to 1968. Thanks for joining me on Preble Hall.
I appreciate it. And check out the link in the description.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.